Welcome to the Science Podcast for September 14th, 2012. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, do-it-yourself lab equipment, the Higgs boson, or is it the Weinberg or the CERN boson, and a look at an unusual phenomenon in killer whales.
These whales have a really, really long post-reproductive lifespan. They stop reproducing in their 30s or 40s, but they live right up into their 90s. And that's a really, really unusual thing to occur.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
There are only a few species on the planet that undergo menopause and live decades beyond. Besides humans, certain types of female whales live well past the reproductive age. Using a census spanning four decades, Emma Foster and colleagues revealed that the extended lives of these female whales affect their male offspring for the better. Foster spoke with Science's Edward Hermy about her research from her office at the University of Exeter.
So there's lots of different populations of killer whales around the world, and each population has a slightly different social structure and social behavior. And a lot of that's to do with the fact that they feed very specifically on different types of prey. And the type that I work on are known as resident-type killer whales, and they feed mainly on salmon. And the resident killer whales have a very unique social structure. Both the sons and daughters will remain with their mothers throughout their lives, so there's no dispersal from the family group. And you can have about four or five generations in one family group, and that's known as the matriline.
So your work tracked the lives of individual whales in two separate populations over several decades. How did you go about studying these animals for such a long time period?
So the majority of this data was collected by Ken Balcom from the Center for Whale Research in the USA and by Graham Ellis and John Ford at the Pacific Biological Station in Canada. And in the early 1970s, biologists were tasked with going out and counting the whales in the Pacific Northwest. What they did was for the first three consecutive years was they passed out questionnaires to anybody who lived or worked around the water. So that was people like lighthouse keepers, ferry boat drivers, fishermen, tugboat drivers, fishery patrol boats, and people just living and using the water recreationally. And the survey simply asked them on a given day to go out and just to count the whales. And so for 3 years, they went out and they took a count of the whales. And in addition to that, they went out and they took a lot of photographs as well. And on further investigation of these photographs, they realized that each killer whale had a very distinct dorsal fin shape and a gray area behind the dorsal fin known as a saddle patch. And that was as unique to each killer whale as our fingerprints are to us. And from that, they found out that it was the same group of whales using this water year on year. And so since then, biologists have been tracking these whales and following them, and using very similar techniques since the 1970s. Each day the whales are in the area. They're located either by searching from the shore or will receive reports in when they're in the area. And then once they've been found, if conditions are suitable, we'll launch a boat, go out on the water with them, and document who's there and who's traveling together, and also collect other additional environmental data.
So you've been running this census for a couple of decades now. Just how long are these whales actually living for?
Well, the census has been running now for about four decades, and killer whales have a very, very long lifespan. Females live up to about 90 years. The oldest one in the southern resident population right now is actually 100 years old.
Wow.
Whereas with the males, they only live up to about their 30s or 40s.
So in your study, you focused on grandmother whales. And so could you talk a little about what was happening with the grandmothers in your research?
What we wanted to look at was these whales have a really, really long post-reproductive lifespan. They stop reproducing in their 30s or 40s, but they live right up into their 90s. Mm-hmm. And that's a really, really unusual thing to occur. It happens in two other species, in humans and in pilot whales. And so we wanted to look at what these grandmothers or what these old post-reproductive females were doing. So we were looking at how their survival impacts the survival of their offspring. So we used the data from the two populations, and we explored what happens in the years following a mother's death. So we're looking at the presence or absence of the mother, And we found, really interestingly, with adult sons, if their mothers die, they have a 14-fold increase in the probability that they're going to die in the year following their mother's death. And that effect was seen to a much, much lesser extent in the daughters.
So yeah, there's definitely an impact of having a grandmother around. What are some of the theories on why there might be this evolutionary advantage for wanting to live longer if you're not actually reproducing?
So there's two theories that can potentially explain why individuals cease reproduction partway through their lifespan. Firstly, it could simply be a byproduct of living longer, and that's not adaptive. Alternatively, it could be an evolved adaptation in which females that cease reproduction early can increase the transmission of their own genes by ensuring the reproductive success of their offspring. In the case of the killer whales, we think it's the latter. We believe that the killer whales' post-reproductive lifespan has evolved to increase the transmission of their genes through their son's reproductive success.
So these whales are becoming what we would consider grandmothers of the pod. They're taking care of their grandchildren, right?
That's a really fascinating question. In humans, there's something called the grandmother hypothesis, which is really well documented. And that's where older females will help to ensure the survival of their genes through helping their grandchildren. However, in the killer whale populations, we believe that the mothers are directing their support more towards their adult offspring, particularly their sons, because their sons will mate outside of the family group, and therefore their offspring don't require any support from either the father or the grandmother. So they help their own children by ensuring their reproductive success and the survival of their own children.
What exactly can a whale do to help another whale?
This is still somewhat of a mystery, and it's something that we really hope to explore in the future. I think the fact that we're struggling to answer this question right now just illustrates how difficult these animals are to study in the wild. They're particularly problematic as they spend the majority of their time below the water, making them very difficult to observe. However, we have a few ideas what could be going on here, and we can speculate that they may provide help with foraging or support during encounters with other whales, but this is something we really hope to explore in the future.
So looking at menopause, it's a natural event that we see in humans and also now in killer whales after they reach a certain age. Are there any other animals in the animal kingdom with this pattern of a long post-reproductive lifespan?
Biologically speaking, menopause is a very bizarre concept, and very few species have a prolonged period of their lifespan where they no longer reproduce. There's some evidence to suggest that this may occur in pilot whales. However, to the best of my knowledge, that's the only other example aside from humans and killer whales. The thing that all three species have in common is they all have incredibly stable social structure. So humans lived in the same villages and had very strong family units. Killer whales have this strong matriarchal society where there's no dispersal. And pilot whales have quite a stable social structure as well. So that is able to facilitate helping.
So you also touched on this earlier, but what are some of your next steps for understanding what's going on in killer whale societies?
I think this is a really exciting question, and it's definitely a really exciting area to be involved in at the moment. The menopause remains one of nature's great mysteries, and we're very lucky to be working with a fantastic data set which spans four decades. And this has allowed us to make exciting breakthroughs in the evolution of menopause. The current paper that we've just having published is part of a much larger project which aims to look at the mechanisms underpinning this prolonged female post-reproductive lifespan. So what we really want to focus on next is exactly how mothers are helping their sons, so really start to get to grips with what they're doing to help increase their survival.
Well, Emma Foster, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you very much.
Emma Foster and colleagues examine the influence of long-lived female killer whales on their male offspring in this week's issue.
More than 6,000 people helped discover the Higgs boson, but it's only named after one person, Peter Higgs, a physicist who theorized about the particle in the 1960s. So if the discovery of the particle wins a Nobel Prize, he takes it home, right? Well, as it turns out, Higgs was neither the first nor the only scientist to predict the particle's existence, making the Nobel Committee's decision all the more difficult. Newswriter Adrian Cho has the story of just who was involved in the discovery of this elusive particle.
The discovery of the Higgs boson, some physicists will tell you, is the biggest thing ever to happen to particle physics. It's certainly the biggest discovery in the last 30 years in particle physics, and it seems entirely likely that the Nobel Committee will at least consider giving the Nobel Prize to the theorists who predicted it. This is all the more likely given that the two teams of experimenters that discovered the thing number 3,000 members apiece.
Mm-hmm.
So picking three, there can be no more than three winners out of 6,000 would seem an almost impossible task. So it would seem much easier to give the prize to the folks who predicted this thing theoretically, but it turns out that there are five of those people, and there's, you know, a real issue of who amongst the five should get the credit.
Well, the boson itself is named after a physicist named Peter Higgs. I would think that maybe he would be a shoo-in for the prize.
I think that that's a sentiment shared by many people. Certainly Peter Higgs, who's a theorist at the University of Edinburgh, played an essential role in all of this. But it's also true that there were two other groups who came up with basically the same idea. And in fact, Higgs was not the first person to publish this idea. That honor went to two researchers from Belgium, François Anlaire and Robert Brout.
Aha, so part of the puzzle here is in figuring out amongst this group of scientists just who did what and when. So let's start with Higgs. What was significant about what he found back in the 1960s?
To understand what Higgs did, you have to really understand the problem that they had and that needed to be solved, right? And basically this comes down to an issue in the so-called standard model of particle physics, which is this theory of all the particles that we know. And this theory was bolted together in the 60s and the 70s. But a key element of this theory is the fact that forces, like the electromagnetic force or the strong force that binds the nucleus, they're carried by force-carrying particles called gauge bosons. So the photon is the gauge boson that carries the electromagnetic force. A particle called the gluon carries the strong force. A fellow named Sheldon Glashow put together a theory that incorporated both the weak nuclear force and the electromagnetic force and assumed that they were carried by these particles called gauge bosons. There was one problem with this theory, which was that those gauge bosons had to be massless. There was no way to make the theory make sense if they had mass. It would go mathematically haywire. But people knew that the weak interaction had to be very short range. That meant that the gauge bosons that carried the weak force had to be very massive. And Peter Higgs and five other people were the people who found a way to explain how these gauge bosons that carry the weak force can get mass without blowing the whole theory up. So that's where the mass element comes in.
But as you state in your article, Higgs and his colleagues may have solved one problem, but they still didn't really see the big picture of what these bosons, about what the Higgs boson actually achieved. So what was he missing?
So how Higgs and these other folks came at it was they were thinking about something entirely different. They were thinking about a thing called spontaneous symmetry breaking. And spontaneous symmetry breaking is the kind of thing that happens when the lowest energy state of some physical system has less symmetry than the internal dynamics of the system has. So that sounds very, very complicated, but here's a way to explain it. Suppose you have a round bottom bowl and you stick a marble in it. The marble will settle right in the middle, and that's the most symmetrical part of this round bottom bowl, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the symmetry is maintained. But suppose that instead of a bowl, you've got like the bottom of a wine bottle. It's got this raised punt in the middle. Then the marble will roll down off the hill in some random direction, and it'll break the symmetry of the situation. So the wine bottle bottom is still symmetric, but in settling into the lowest energy state, the marble breaks that symmetry.
Right.
And Higgs was thinking about this. Lots of people were thinking about this. You know, maybe this could be applicable to particle physics because it turns out you can explain things like superconductivity as a form of spontaneous symmetry breaking. You can explain magnetism and magnets as a form of spontaneous symmetry breaking. So there was this hope that it would be a new tool for particle physics. But this guy, Jeffrey Goldstone, who's now at MIT, proved something about spontaneous symmetry breaking, or it appeared to, that said that if you do this, you'll end up with all these massless particles flittering, you know, hither and yon. And since there aren't lots and lots of massless particles cruising around the universe, this seems to suggest that spontaneous symmetry breaking is not really applicable to the real world. Enter Higgs and company. And what they did is they looked at the exact same model that Goldstone had looked at, but they realized, hey, what Goldstone doesn't put in this are these sort of force-carrying particles. And they say, okay, well, what if we do that, right? What if we add these force-carrying particles, these so-called gauge bosons? And it turns out that if you do that, two really weird things happen. First thing is that all the little massless particles that were running around in Goldstone's model disappear. They evaporate. And the other thing is that the force-carrying particles in your theory all of a sudden gain mass. So when these guys did this, Higgs and these five other people, at some level their real interest was to show that you could get rid of all these massless particles that the so-called Goldstone theorem said had to exist, right? What they missed was the fact that they had now found a way to give mass to force-carrying particles, and that would be the key step in folding together the Standard Model.
So that may sum up Peter Higgs's contribution to the Standard Model, but you mentioned that there are other possible contenders for the Nobel here. So who are they, and what were their roles in all of this?
So Higgs was not the only guy to come up with this idea. In fact, there were three groups that basically all had the same idea at roughly the same time. And the first people to spell out this mechanism for giving mass to force-carrying particles was a duo, François Anlaire and Robert Brout of the Free University of Brussels. Then Higgs followed, and then there was a team of two Americans and a Brit, the Americans being Gerald Gorelnik and Carl Hagen, and the Brit being Tom Kibble of Imperial College London. And they all basically had the same idea. The details of their paper are somewhat different, but they all came up with the same basic mechanism for giving mass to force-carrying particles. But none of them actually figured out that what this was good for was to give mass to the particles that carry the weak force, right? Hmm. And that fell to a fellow named Steven Weinberg, who is now at the University of Texas, Austin, and Pakistani physicist Abdus Salam, who died in 1996. And Weinberg and Salam, along with Sheldon Glashow, shared the Nobel Prize in 1979 for putting this theory together. At the same time, there's this issue of whether or not these six people actually predicted the thing that you call the Higgs boson, because, mm-hmm. you know, the real Higgs boson, the one with all the properties that have been so precisely predicted and, you know, appear to be verified in the experiments, the real Higgs boson comes out of the theory of Weinberg, Glashow, and Salam.
So we have all of these scientists, all with partial contributions to, you know, the idea that we now know is the Higgs boson. So who do you think the front runners are for the Nobel? Is it too early to tell?
Well, people tend to think that Higgs is a shoo-in, in part because in this crazy mechanism whereby there's this field in the vacuum that's giving mass to the force-carrying particles, that field in the background is itself made up of quantum particles, which are kind of hidden in the vacuum. And those particles hidden in the vacuum are, in fact, the Higgs boson. And Higgs was the only person in the 1964 papers to mention that this field would be made up of massive bosons. And so a number of people have told me, well, if you need to find a way to make a distinction, you can make this distinction that Higgs was the only guy to say, and this field has to be made up of quantum particles, and that quantum particle is the thing that they were looking for. So people seem to think that Higgs is pretty much a shoo-in. People say that Anlaire has a real shot at this because, in fact, he was the first guy out with this basic physical mechanism to give mass to force-carrying particles, which is now called the Higgs mechanism. There seems to be some sentiment out there that Gorelnik, Hagen, and Kibble were simply too late, but obviously they see things differently. It's also entirely possible that they could try to pick somebody out of these two teams of 3,000 people apiece to give the Nobel Prize for the actual experimental work that discovered it. But that seems like an even harder challenge.
Well, I am sitting at the edge of my seat. Adrian Cho, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
News writer Adrian Cho asks the question, who invented the Higgs boson, in a News Focus this week.
Want more science in your life? Check us out on Facebook and Twitter at Science Magazine, where you can read highlights, join discussions, or take your best shot at our weekly quiz.
Ordinary items around the lab can be extraordinarily expensive, some with good reason, like specialty devices built for specific experiments. I spoke with Joshua Pierce about the do-it-yourself, or DIY, lab movement that uses 3D printers to create common and uncommon tools.
As we take the process of development that has succeeded in open source software and apply it to hardware, an opportunity has arisen to radically reduce the cost of experimental research in the sciences. Specifically, the combination of open source 3D printing and microcontrollers running on free and open source software enables the development of powerful research tools at unprecedented low costs. We are on the verge of a new era where low-cost scientific equipment puts increasingly sophisticated tools into the hands of the public and amateur scientists throughout the world while driving down the cost of research tools at our most prestigious laboratories.
In your perspective, you talk about a solution to this problem that's grown out of the open source software movement. How does that fit in with this?
The free and open source software movement has really established itself as a superior method of making software code. And the trick or the secret behind it is just that you have a lot of people collaborating. You have a large team working to innovate together. And that same trick can be applied from open source software to now open source hardware, where you're sharing digital designs and you're getting lots of people to comment and to make improvements that then we can all build off of.
And so what do you do with these digital designs? How are they used?
One of the most powerful tools that has come out of open source hardware is the Arduino microcontroller. And this is an open source microcontroller that's very easy to program and learn how to use, and they're relatively inexpensive to purchase. So you can buy one for, say, $20. And from that, people have made all different kinds of scientific tools, from the Arduino Geiger, which is a radiation detector, to a pHduino, which is a pH meter. They've made oscilloscopes for electrical engineers and OpenPCR to do DNA analysis. But the most powerful tool that's kind of come out of it is the open source 3D printer. And so you can use an open source microcontroller, sort of the brain of the machine, to make additive layer manufacturing, where you lay a two-dimensional surface down and melted plastic usually, and then move up a fraction of a millimeter and lay down another layer and continue to do that until you build up a three-dimensional object. And you can take then the designs, the digital designs, either a CAD or an open source code, like a computer code, to make a three-dimensional object that then anybody else can replicate anywhere in the world. And the beauty of this is that the first person to make an open source 3D printer also made it partially self-replicating. So the RepRap can print 50% of its own parts today, and it continues to evolve in this open source paradigm so that today's version is better than the one last week and will continue to do so indefinitely until we have it down.
All right. So besides printing itself, what other kinds of things can this 3D printer make?
Okay, so for scientists, can do all the simple stuff in, say, a typical chemistry lab, BioRacks or a Buechner funnel. They can do microwell plates for doing little tiny test tubes. It can also be used to print customized reactionware. And this is an area of chemical research that we haven't really looked into yet because we didn't have the capabilities. So now you can use the geometry of the design or the ability to embed catalysts inside the actual reactionware, and you're printing those designs. And so that means you can change the CAD very quickly on the computer and then print out another set of reactionware to test a new chemical process.
So what you're talking about there is very specifically shaped vessels so that you can have chemical reactions occur on a tiny scale in a certain order?
Correct. Okay. And in a way that maybe hasn't been tested yet. And so you can test a whole big bunch of them very quickly to get access to new chemical species that you haven't looked at before. Then it can be combined with things that, say, you can buy in the hardware store. Or one of my favorites is the Dremel Fuge. So you take a Dremel, which is just a high-speed drill that you probably already have at your home, and you can print out a chuck for it that can hold little vials so that you can create a centrifuge. And this is high quality. It has excellent RPM and G values for basically the cost of the drill. So for about $50, you can have yourself a high-speed centrifuge that would normally cost several hundred.
But that kind of brings up some of the limitations that there might be about this technique, is that there's precision and then there's how sturdy something is and those kinds of things. Is that going to be a problem when you're printing your own equipment?
Yes, to some degree. So for some applications, I would say that the printers aren't there yet, the open source versions. We have the ability to print in all different kinds of plastics. The most common are ABS and PLA. So ABS is sort of like what you make Lego blocks out of. Mm-hmm. But we can also attach a syringe to the printer and start to print in things like silicones or any type of paste material or even ceramics that you then fire later. So you can get very close to the same capabilities that you could through another manufacturing process. But in general, these low-cost kind of RepRap printers that cost less than $1,000 to make can't get really high tolerances or really fantastic material or mechanical properties. This is an evolving process. Right now, we're kind of at the hacker stage, where you have to be willing to mess around with things a little bit in order to get them to do what you want.
And so you also mentioned that there's a way of depositing these tools and making them available to all. What kinds of things, what kind of recipes can you find on this site?
Well, Thingiverse is probably the largest site for sharing of digital designs, of real physical objects. I just checked this morning, and there's over 30,000 things available. And they range from art and toys and little toys like Lincoln Logs to very complicated toys like quadcopters, household items, learning items, but kind of most interesting to scientists are scientific equipment and tools. And that is a small but growing rapidly area of interest in this kind of DIY design community.
So Have you made anything for your lab using this technique?
Oh, absolutely. One of the biggest success stories in my lab, we took a design for an open source laser cutter that a Canadian had worked on, and we turned it into an open source laser welding system. And for that specific line of research, we're looking at microchannel polymer heat exchangers. And nobody's really looked at this yet, and so it's kind of a wide open design space, and we needed a way to be able to make prototypes very quickly. And the first prototype that we ever got working, we actually used a German firm, and it cost us thousands of dollars to make a single heat exchanger. Well, now we can make one an hour using this open source tool, and because the original design had a Creative Commons license on it, that indicated that we had to share any designs that we took and share it back to the community, we shared ours back to the community. So now anyone in the world that wants to replicate what we're doing with polymer heat exchangers can very easily do that. And so this saved us thousands and thousands of dollars on, you know, having someone else do the prototypes for us, but also in the design time itself. Because the Canadian had already done all the mechanical work on it, we changed the electronics on a small amount of the mechanics, so we had to make a couple new prints. But our design time was much lower. And so now we're saving literally, I mean, we're printing some out now, so we're saving thousands of dollars. We've also done a whole big bunch of stuff in our lab concerning optics. We primarily look at solar photovoltaics. So we've printed out everything from lab jacks to optical filter wheels to chopper wheels, sample holders, lens holders, mirror mounts, anything that would be useful for our lab that we would need anyway. In each one of those cases, we're decreasing the cost by sometimes, say, $25 for a simple lens holder, but sometimes it can be quite substantial.
Wow. Whenever we talk about sharing and free software and all that kind of stuff, it brings up the question of copyright and patenting. Is that something that you have to consider when you look at what's been deposited in Thingiverse or other places like that?
To date, the things that have been put on Thingiverse have been designed by either other scientists or hobbyists, and so they're normally under some sort of Creative Commons license, which means that you're allowed to print and use it for yourself. And at some point, we might run into trouble, but I know for at least on the open source 3D printing side of things, any additive layer manufacturing patents that would infringe on it have long since gone out of date. And so what we're basically doing is building up a separate repository of open source designs. Like, that's what the U.S. Patent Office is, only in their case, they have sort of like a 20-year backlog. And in this case, everything is instantaneous. And so just as an example with that lab jack, a lab jack is basically like a car jack, only it's much smaller and a little bit more precise. In our case, we want to use it to move a sample up and down very precisely in front of a laser beam. And we had gotten a quote for one that was $1,000, and that seemed abhorrent to me for something that's so simple. There's cheaper versions that are available on the web for a few hundred and even some really kind of questionable quality ones down to about $25. So we designed one that could be printed from scratch. So it's not like any of the other ones because that wasn't a design consideration they were putting into it. But as soon as I posted it, within an hour, someone from Finland had made recommendations for how to make it a little bit better. Huh. And so we, of course, made the alterations. Now, so we have a superior lab jack to the one that my lab was capable of designing because we had help from someone that we'd never met and is completely unaffiliated with our lab. And that will continue to happen. So dozens of people have said they like the lab jack because they're going to be using it presumably for their own work. And altering the shape or the conformation or how it's attached to it for their own applications. And so every day, the technology behind that open source lab jack gets better.
Great. All right, Joshua Pierce, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Joshua Pierce is the author of A Perspective on a New Source of Lab Equipment in this week's Science.
Finally today, I'm Carrie Klein, and I'm here with news writer Carolyn Gramling, filling in for David Grimm, and she's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. So, Carolyn, in our first story, we are talking about a creature that we love to make fun of.
Yes, when people think of lemmings, they probably think of a giant wave of rodents crashing off of a hillside into the ocean. But in point of fact, they don't actually commit mass suicide in that way. However, they do have these periodic population booms. These are Arctic rodents, by the way. And so as a result of their population booms, they tend to migrate en masse, and that's sort of what gives rise to that myth. So their numbers wax and wane over a four-year cycle, and around the turn of the millennium, scientists noticed that they actually did not have their expected population boom in their habitat in northeastern Greenland. And so they were interested in why this was the case. They believe that that's due to changes in their habitat due to global warming. But the thing is that lemmings are actually a popular prey for a lot of Arctic predators. And low lemming numbers, therefore, actually have a really significant impact on those predators also. Hmm. So it spells big trouble for the predators, such as, for example, stoats and a type of seabird known as a skua.
Okay.
It spells big trouble for them because their prey is vanishing.
That's right.
So a lot of them are potentially going locally, at least in these regions of Greenland, maybe going locally extinct.
So what does this mean for these predators? Is there any chance of them bouncing back?
Well, one of the things that they're looking at now with some of the predators is, you know, whether or not they're able to prey switch. And that's also a big issue. Some of them are, some aren't. The ones that are, they might be switching their prey to more migratory birds, for example. But, of course, then that becomes a problem for the migratory bird populations. So it's very interesting because ultimately the point is that the plight of the lemmings is actually felt throughout the entire Arctic ecosystem.
Indeed. We can add this to the list of new patterns emerging as climate change continues.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. And in our next story, we're talking about a highly anticipated dengue vaccine.
Yes, this is something that scientists have been very eager to develop. They're looking for a new vaccine for dengue fever, which is an infectious tropical disease that affects about 100 million people, mostly children, worldwide. And this is a disease
that's
that is
every year.
And that's every year, yes. Yeah. And that is a disease that is caused by a virus and is spread by mosquitoes. And the trick is with dengue that there are actually four variants to this disease, to the virus. And right now, of course, there are no approved vaccines for it. But any ideal vaccine is going to be both safe for the vaccinees and also will protect against those four variants.
And so these were the first clinical trials for a new dengue vaccine. Clearly, there's a high demand for it. How did the trials turn out?
Well, they're sort of mixed results. So what they did in these trials was they tested more than 4,000 children in Thailand, splitting them into control groups and into vaccination groups. Mm-hmm. And what they found was that while the vaccine was fairly effective against three of the types of virus, of dengue virus, it actually did not at all protect against the fourth type, which also happens to be the type that is responsible for the most severe illness in the world and is also currently circulating in Thailand.
So it's not quite accurate to say that the vaccine is 75% effective.
No, no, not exactly. They do really want something that is going to be able to prevent against all four, because incomplete protection could actually be very dangerous for the vaccinees. Hmm. So what they're trying to do now is they're actually testing the vaccine in 10 different countries around the world among 31,000 people. And those results we won't actually see until 2014. So they're not yet able to say what's going to come next with this vaccine.
Well, all right. And our third story today sheds some light on bioluminescence.
Yes, bioluminescence is something that is very common to a lot of different marine species. They use it often to find mates or to also find food or as a way of avoiding predators. Mm-hmm. So we've known that a lot of floating creatures exhibit bioluminescence, this light that they emit.
And so we do already know a lot about bioluminescence. What's new in this story?
Well, so these researchers were actually interested not just in looking at the kinds of creatures floating in the ocean that show bioluminescence, but what creatures on the seafloor bioluminesce. And this is something that has been a lot less studied. So they were looking for organisms such as sea anemones, coral, shrimp, crabs, that sort of thing that crawl around on the seafloor, so-called benthic organisms.
Mm-hmm. And so what did they find?
What they found was that actually about 20% of these species do show bioluminescence, and that was higher than they originally expected. But what's also really interesting was not just how many of them showed it, but how often they glowed. And what they thought was that this might have to do with what actually prompts them to bioluminesce. That has to do with how often they actually bump into other objects. Usually these creatures would start to glow when you touch them. What they hypothesize is that creatures floating in the ocean actually don't bump into other objects very often, so that doesn't prompt them to glow. But the creatures crawling around on the seafloor, they're going to hit other creatures or bump up against corals or be jostled by other objects, and so that causes them to glow quite often.
And so this sort of addresses the bioluminescence paradox, if you will, that there are fewer creatures that bioluminesce towards the bottom of the ocean, but that they luminesce more because of this proximity.
Yes, exactly.
So the title of this story actually includes vomiting shrimp. What role do these vomiting shrimp play in this story?
Yes, well, so one of these benthic creatures that it turns out bioluminesces quite a lot has a very unusual way of doing it. It actually vomits these bioluminescent chemicals into the water around it.
Wow.
And that is how it exhibits this trait.
Wow. Well, I am going to have to get myself out to the tropics to see these firsthand. All right. So what else have we had on the news site this week?
Well, on Science Now this week, you can find out about how scientists have helped deaf gerbils hear again using stem cells, how a Facebook message influenced the elections in 2010, and how a cliff-dwelling plant is using ants to help it reproduce. And also on our policy blog, Science Insider, you can learn all about the Golden Goose Awards, which are for researchers who pursue oddball topics that turn out to have actual health or economic benefits. And finally, next week on Science Live, you can chat with experts about whether eating less can actually make you live longer. You can check out all of this and, of course, a lot more on our website, news.sciencemag.org.
Great. Thanks, Carolyn.
Thank you.
Carolyn Gramling is a news writer for Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now and science policy from Science Insider. While you're there, be sure to check out Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the September 14th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.